In series 7 of Events That Made Me, which is Boardroom to Box Office, you don't get more boardroom than my guest today, who became the CEO of one of the world's leading banking families. So what is life like at the top? I'm Liz Taylor, and today on Events That Made Me, you're going to find out. My guest is Richard Bailey. He's the former CEO of Rothschild & Co, and he's the non-executive director of many other businesses.
I said, look, either you go and you go tonight or tomorrow, it will be in the papers.
Richard has business in his blood. He's a toughie, but he's fair. He's a no-bullshit kind of guy, which I like, and he has a steel underlay. He told me how he formed his relationship with money at a very young age.
Both my parents came from essentially mining families. And whilst I, myself and my sister had a very, you know, I suppose comfortable upbringing, there was never any money. My mother in particular was always very conscious of that. And so she had left school at 14, retired at 65, died at 67, and worked all her life. And it kind of gave me a picture, if you like, of an existence which I did not want to live. So money was always a motivator. And I didn't really know how, what, or why that was going to happen. But it was always instilled into me, if you like, that that was something which was really important. So I went to what was a very good boys' grammar school, small boys' grammar school, the King's School in Pontefract, having been to a local to home infant and junior school, which was basically populated by children of mining families. So very ordinary, nice kids, very ordinary. King's School was a real revelation in the sense that it gave me and my pals the sort of education which now you'd pay a lot of money for. So it was 700 boys. It had an Oxbridge intake of about 60 boys each year. And most of the boys from there went on to university or college.
Are you still in touch with some of them?
Yes, I am, funnily enough.
Are you?
Yeah, so they're all over the world. But the remarkable thing is that many of them have gone on to do great things. So there was something in the education there that I think was a real driver.
I also think, Richard, that it was in our, and I say that I include myself, I think it was in our generation. I think that it was instilled into us that, you know, you had to work to get your money. I mean, I had a Saturday job at 14 and I came from a privileged background, but you had to work to get your money.
Yeah.
But what made me giggle was that you're running this huge international bank. You're doing massive deals for people, which we're going to come on to, but you failed maths O level.
No, I didn't fail maths O level. What I was trying to describe was the fact that I did my maths O level and I got a 2, I think, if I remember correctly. But then I didn't do any maths from then till I took up doing accountancy. So doing accountancy with all the statistical analysis and all of that went with the qualification was a nightmare.
That was at PwC, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was probably your first big stepping stone into the financial auditorium, so to speak.
Yes, yes. I mean, I went to, from King's School, I went to Manchester University, having had a year off. First of all, working in a beach club in Corsica, and then stodding around France for most of the remaining months of that year. And I had a place at Sussex to do some ology or other. And I completely changed my mind and I got into Manchester to do English and American literature. And it was the best thing I ever did, to be honest. It was fantastic. It was a wonderful course, wonderful tutors. And I think, as I always say to my kids, you know, it taught me to read and write. You know, and that was key, if you like, I think, to a lot of what I did subsequently. Because I think communication, as you well know, Liz, is just so much a big part of providing service, a professional service. It's all right being a good technician. At the end of the day, you've got to be able to communicate.
It's interesting because you're obviously a bit like a sponge because, you know, so far you mentioned that you were going to do an ology, whether it be theology or whatever, then you did history, then you did English. And I think that's really very relevant because you're obviously, it sounds very patronizing. It's not meant to sort of an all-rounder. But one of the things that you put in the events you sent over to me, and it's so, so true, is that PwC taught you that turnover is vanity.
Yes.
And that really resonated with me because we all get sort of so immersed in how much the turnover is, but what the actual profit is.
Yeah.
So just fast forward a little bit from PwC as to how you ended up at Rothschilds.
The interesting thing about Price Waterhouse at that time, and I was based in or attached to the Leeds office, was that it had a very, very broad spectrum of clients. So everything from textiles through potato merchants, engineering companies, cosmetics companies, chemical companies. So the experience that you got there was probably unrepeatable today. From that, I got involved in my later time after I qualified in what they now call an insolvency department, insolvency practice of Price Waterhouse. And I ended up doing a job for Barclays Bank, who had a bad loan out to a company which is no longer exists. It was a public company called Cope Sportswear. And they made menswear, basically, in Yorkshire. And Geoffrey Cope was a bit of a mad entrepreneur, really. And he'd gone in over his head. So we were trying to sort this business out, in truth.
Richard, was he that big fat guy, Geoffrey Cope? And he's dead now, so no one can have a derby.
Correct,
yeah, I know what you mean.
You know who I mean. And anyway, so Rothschilds were acting on the other side on behalf of the board. So we did this job, and I can't remember how long it took now, several weeks, I think. And afterwards, a headhunter actually contacted me and said, I'm acting for Rothschilds. Would you like to come and have an interview? And I said, in my ignorance, I said, what to do? And they said, to do corporate finance work. So I said, I'm really not sure what corporate finance in that context is. So anyway, I went along, had an interview, and they offered me a job. And it was about 50, 60% more than I was earning at the time. So I thought, give it a whirl for 2 years. And, just see how it goes, really. And then sort of 38 years later, I retired. So it was a bizarre, bizarre experience, really, and shift.
But he was very supportive of you, wasn't he, Evelyn de Rothschild?
Evelyn was a complete enigma, really, in the sense that he was a very imposing guy, sort of 6'5", 6'6", quite large. Had been a playboy in his youth, he'd gone out with film stars, models, had had a very, very privileged life. But he was very awkward, cantankerous, difficult guy, very volatile, and quite scary, actually. When I first met him, I thought, bloody hellfire, here's a monster, really. But in truth, I actually, over time, first of all, got on with him because I could kind of read him, I thought. And secondly, he was became, to me anyway, very sort of empathetic. And he had the, I suppose, temerity, bravery, whatever you call it, to, after I think I'd been there about 7 or 8 years, and appointed me to the board, which was amazing to me, to be honest.
Were there many non-family members on the board at that time?
Yes, there were. It was completely family controlled. And most of my colleagues were, as you might imagine at that time, public school, Oxbridge, very male dominated. So I was, a little bit of an anomaly, really, in truth, particularly with my Yorkshire hard vowels. It was always a source of amusement to certain people, bath, graft, and so on.
Maybe that's why you only ever ended up in Manchester, really, yeah, and not in London or Paris. Yeah. But During that time, you sent me through some really, really impressive challenges and deals, and some with clients of mine. So I know the people that you were dealing with, and, you know, John Whittaker, Dave Whelan, and they're going to get to the Dave Whelan one shortly. But what would you consider to be your most successful deal and why?
That's really quite a difficult one, because I suppose the deals that I found most satisfying were, if you like, the most difficult ones. You may remember, Liz, but there was a 2-year battle for John Whittaker over the takeover of Manchester Ship Canal. And it was enormously difficult because it had
I'm just going to interrupt you now, because for the listeners, for the purpose of the listeners, John Whittaker is an entrepreneur, but he's probably most famous for owning the Trafford Centre. That's what the listeners will know him for, is Peel Holdings, and he owns the Trafford Centre. But sorry, carry on.
So John had spotted the opportunity, if you like, which I can come back to. But this company and its board were locked in a very old-fashioned shareholding structure, which was almost impossible to penetrate. And so it was a real challenge. And more than that, it had a major shareholder in a chap called Nicholas Berry, whose family owned the Telegraph. And Nicholas was a pretty bright, difficult guy and put up a lot of opposition to it. Anyway, to cut a long story short, John had seen the opportunity, that the land attached to the ship canal, the opportunity to develop all of that land where the Trafford Centre sits, is a good example, but much more than that. The Trafford Centre is, if you like, the most prominent, but in truth, the real wealth of that deal came out of all the attendant land right along the ship canal, right down to Liverpool. And the second one, again for John, was mopping up quite a lot of the UK ports industry. And again, I suppose the most well-known would be Mersey Docks and Harbour Company. Again, it was a sort of sleepy, underperforming business. And, you know, John, we managed to take that business over after a struggle. And it was making no money, really, that business, when John bought it. Along with the other ports that we assembled over time, that business now makes, the Peel Ports, that is, makes about 250, 260 million of EBITDA every year. So it's a huge business, created out of nothing. And it was those are two examples of John's incredible foresight and ability to spot opportunities and to take risks, big risks in terms of both reputation and financial risk, which, you know, on a couple of occasions could have brought him down in truth, but in reality, paid off big time, big, big time.
Do you remember the party in the Isle of Man?
I remember it extremely well. John was somebody I worked for all of my career, really, and someone who I liked and still like enormously, because he's a very, very engaging sort of guy, very funny, very eccentric in many ways. But he, I suppose one of the things that was always sticks in my mind socially rather than business-wise is that for many years he used to sort of tease me, because I ski, I love to ski, and he kept saying, well, oh, you ought to come on one of our heli-skiing trips. So, which he does with his boys every year, or did do. Anyway, one year, I finally said to him, I said, okay, John, right, I'll go with you. These trips are always in Canada. So I sort of went along not knowing really what was going to happen. And it was hell. It was hell.
He's very competitive. He's so competitive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Always has to be first down the slope, you know. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so I went through this week and kind of got to the end of it. And there was a dinner at the end when everybody sort of let their hair down, because it's quite a difficult athletic week, really. And anyway, there were various toasts given. John looked at me and said, I never knew you had it in you. And I got the award, which was Man of Steel.
There you go. And I referred to you at the very beginning of this interview as having a steel underlay.
Yeah.
Very quickly, very, very quickly with John Whittaker, because it's a long story. But yeah. I've flown into the Isle of Man to meet him for this party. And as you know, he's very intimidating. He's not a guy that looks you in the eye. And I went into the house in the Isle of Man, which is a little bit, it was not like a mausoleum, but it's huge. You know, he's got his ballroom and everything else. And we sat and we had lunch and he likes a glass of champagne and I didn't have a drink. And I put on this very beautiful, brand new, and you'll know because your wife Hilary is a good shopper, Italian trouser suit. And he had this mutt, this dog that was all over me and the hairs were all over.
No, yeah, yeah.
And he took me in the other room after lunch and he sat down and this dog jumped on my knee all over me and I'm like cringing in there. And I gave him a fee and he looked at me and he gave me a fee. He came back with £5,000 less.
Yeah.
And I said to him, John, it's not a negotiable fee. That is the fee. And he turned around to me and said, well, he said, you know, my dog's never taken to anybody like he's taken to you. He said, so you've got the job. Just tell me, you also mentioned, and I'm intrigued, Stephen Hinchcliffe. Now, forgive my ignorance. I don't know who Stephen Hinchcliffe was, but this was something that you flew back to sack somebody. I mean, just tell me about it.
Oh, well, Liz, it was worse than that. I had the family in the car on a ramp going onto a ferry in Dover to go down to the Alps to ski. And I ended up reversing off this damn ramp with all the traffic behind me to get off to go back into the centre of London in order to do the deed, much to Hillary's disgust, as you might imagine. The story was this, that Stephen Hinchcliffe was a very prominent Sheffield entrepreneur. Larger than life. You know, if you ever went up to his offices, which was a stately home just outside of Sheffield, you know, there'd be a line of Rolls Royces and Ferraris with, you know, with Hinch 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know. So massive ego, this guy. Anyway, he had got control of a public company called James Wilkes. And James Wilkes was an old, quoted Sheffield engineering group. And it got, or was this subject of a hostile takeover by another engineering business. And we were appointed to defend James Wilkes. And I discovered through the good offices of an old, now sadly dead friend who was a foot in the door journalist for the News of the World in his past. He did some digging for me and found out a lot of, call it not very nice things about said Hinchcliffe, which basically involved fraud. More to the point, there was some evidence of that going on within Wilkes. So I sort of made the decision that from a Rothschild point of view, from a Rothschild reputational point of view, I didn't want to defend this man, or I didn't want to defend the business while he was in charge. He was the executive chairman. I gave him an ultimatum before I left on this trip. Anyway, he reneged on it. He said he would do it. He said he'd resign. He said he would go because I threatened to go to the papers with it. And he didn't. He conducted a meeting. He went to a press conference and gave him a load of blarney about why Wilkes was such a good business and he'd done such fantastic things for it. So I went back into London, parked Hillary and the children in a hotel, went into a meeting room in Rothschild's offices in London. I'd summoned the brokers there, who were, I think, Rowan Pittman from memory, to the same meeting. And before the meeting started, I collared the partner from Rowan Pittman and said, look, you know, I need your backing on this because we're both going to walk if he doesn't go. And we will do that very publicly. And remember, we're in the middle of a very public takeover bid at this stage. So anyway, you know, we went into the meeting and Hinchcliffe gave another load of blarney about, you know, why he wasn't going to go and why he was so critical to the business. And at that point, I just said to him, so look, I delivered the second ultimatum. I said, look, I'm not hanging about any longer with this. Either you go and you go tonight or tomorrow it will be in the papers that we've walked. And I looked at the guy, Rowan Pittman, who by this time was sort of squirming. And I said, that's right, Robin, isn't it? You know, and Robin sort of thought about it for about a minute and then said, yes, that's right, Richard. And the guy went. But it was a tough old period, because then we had to change the board, reappoint or appoint some people in order to carry on the defence. And then the other side came out with a load of bile about Wilkes and how it had been run. And that was a difficult old defence. We ended up in front of the panel on takeovers and mergers, where there was an inquiry. So very, very difficult. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, the guy who then became CEO, a chap called Arthur Watt, and I became great friends, and he's still a great friend, because I sort of backed him throughout this horror story, really. And he went on and did a brilliant job with the business. Absolutely brilliant. So, yeah.
I started this podcast during lockdown because I was able to access my black book because nobody was doing anything. They wanted to do it. Myself, my inspiration is a podcast called Business Wars. And I don't know if you've ever listened to it.
No.
But it's like-minded. So you've got FedEx and DHL, and you've got Hershey, and you've got Mars, and then the same businesses. And it's the wars. It's how, you know, what they did and how they built the business, the ruthlessness of each of them. And it's really quite interesting. And you obviously have been very ruthless. You're certainly an intimidating individual. Is there a business decision or business advice that you gave that you, in retrospect, regret?
Yes. I can think of several, really, where, you know, things that developed subsequently in a business, which, you know, they either went wrong or they, you know, one or two failed, you know. But I always sort of comforted myself in the belief that I did my best. I gave the best advice I could on the day, and then it was over to management and, you know, board to carry those things out. And usually it was the fact that they didn't follow the advice. And I can think of a very pertinent example of that, which was there was a quoted steel stockholder business based in Bradford, actually, but one of the largest in the UK. Great business. And it, during one of the recessions, got into problems with its banks. And I did a lot of work in negotiating with the banks to make sure this business survived. And in the middle of all this, two of the directors, who were brothers, actually, did something very silly in terms of a financial decision that was extremely provocative to the lead bank, completely against my advice. And literally, within 24 hours, the bank had appointed an administrator. And I often look at that and think, you know, the silly beggars. You know, it could have all been so different. And sadly, the elder of the two brothers, who was the CEO, he died not long ago of cancer. He was a client. He was quite a good friend, actually. And we fell out over that because I was incandescent with him, having done this thing, which I won't go into. But it was a stupid thing to do. So, yeah, you know, I think about those things. I suppose the other thing, which was still really sort of rankled to me, is the fact that, you know, we built up that mid-cap business within Rothschild, which, as I said in my note to you, at one point was bigger than the whole of Close Brothers. And when that last 2008 recession hit, it was mayhem. So, you know, I had 165, 170 people working within that business. And, you know, we had to sell businesses, we had to restructure the business. You know, it was like sort of destroying the thing that you'd built, really. And that was the thing that really rankled me. And at the same time, I had six other client businesses who were going through similar things. So not only was I having to deal with what was going on in the Rothschild business, I was having to deal with the nightmares that these six were going through. And that was a very, very trying period, let me tell you.
Tell me about Dave Whelan, because, as you know, Dave Whelan is a great, having been a client many years. I think it was the first event I did for him, I think, was his 60th. But then I did parties for Wigan and I did all sorts of parties. And now I have the privilege of staying with him every new year at Maddox, which is in Barbados, because as a result, I have a relationship with his daughter. But so tell me about the pies, because I remember the party.
Well, you'll know, Liz, that he, amongst other things, he owns a business in Wigan called Poole's Pies.
Does he still own it?
Yeah, I think so. And Dave, you know, was a great fan of, call it plain eating, you know, so pies being one of his favourites. And he would always profess that, you know, Poole's Pies were the best pies you'll ever eat, sort of thing. Anyway, we were conducting a transaction and there was a big meeting in his offices in Wigan, attended by a group of female lawyers from Linklaters and some other people from Price Waterhouse, one of whom was a female partner there. And there were all of these, you know, very talented, able ladies, were all a bit West End, if you know what I mean. You know, sort of Kensington girls, you know. Anyway, so we're having this meeting and it's it goes on and on and on. Dave gets bored about halfway through the meeting, so he goes off to do something else. And it gets to about 1 o'clock and Dave comes through the door and says, right, boys and girls, lunchtime. So we all, and I knew what was coming, but clearly this lot didn't. And so so this lady is, you know, in the white coat and the hat and everything from the kitchen, follows him through on a bloody great trolley. Of course, what's in it, as Dave proudly announced, is Poole's Pies. I can see the faces of these these people just drop, you know. And then to cap it all, he said, if you don't like those, he said, there's brisket.
Richard, when I started going to Barbados for New Year 6-7 years ago, and I was not in a great place, and Jane invited me to join them, and I've now, this is my 7th year this year, or 8th year. On the 3rd year, and you have to bear in mind, the home is Maddox, and it was owned by Oliver Messel, and it was where Princess Margaret honeymooned, so it's just magnificent.
Yeah.
And he sits at the top of the table every morning, and you have to sit there, 9 o'clock for breakfast, 1 o'clock for lunch, and 7 o'clock for drinks, and 8 o'clock for dinner. Anyway, as I was leaving the 2nd or 3rd year, I went over to him and said, Dave, I said, I just really want to thank you for your hospitality. I've had the most wonderful time. He said, oh, don't worry, love. He said, we take a vote on who comes next year. So I said, well, don't worry, Dave. I said, I'll vote for you. Oh, God, there's so many stories that we could probably share, but I just want to move on to your philanthropic side. And I know that you are... Is it you that plays the piano or Hillary?
No, it's me.
And did you study music?
No. It's just I've had a lifelong love of music, and both classical, modern, jazz, pop, if you like. So it's something that's always interested me. And I don't play the piano well. I wouldn't pretend to, but I enjoy playing. So now I'm, you know, retired. It's a good brain exercise. As well as being something pleasurable to do.
Tell me, I want you to tell the listeners about Chetham's, because Chetham's is you know, iconic in Manchester.
Yeah.
And you have raised, if I'm right in thinking, $34 million for Chetham's.
Yeah.
What inspired you to do it and how did you do it?
Well, I got involved with Chet's, I suppose, because of my... interest in music, but probably even more important is my interest in education. And a friend, Paul Lee, approached me and said, oh, you know, would you become treasurer some years ago now at Chetts? You know, we've got, you know, a number of things going on. And I went along, I'd been to some concerts there before, I think. Anyway, I went along, had a bit of a tour with the headmistress and, you know, just was absolutely knocked out by the talents of these kids. And for those that don't know, there are basically four major institutions in the UK for educating talented musicians, dancers, actors and actresses, of which Chetts is probably the leading music school by a long, long way, probably in Europe, actually. And it's 300-odd kids, and they are there purely because of their musical talent. Anyway, so I did this initial tour, went on the board of trustees, and then one of the headmistress said to me, "Oh, you know, the boys' house, you know, it needs some quite a lot of refurbishment." And it was in a bit of a state. I mean, it was like something out of, you know, the poorhouse, Charles Dickens, you know, Dickensian. It was dreadful. So somebody had said, well, it needs about 2 million quid spending on it. Anyway, so I got another pal who you may know, Liz, Roger Stevenson, who's a well-known local, very good architect. And Roger came up and had a look around these premises with me. And anyway, we went for a drink afterwards. And I said, what would you do, Roger? He said, I'd knock it down. So I said, no, we can't do that. It's listed. So anyway, so that discussion then developed into a much grander plan, which was to essentially build a new school and then decant the existing classrooms into the new school, develop those areas into better accommodation, so on. Anyway, so the project mushroomed into this 35, 36 million quid project. So it was massive and beset with all sorts of obstacles because of the status of the... There are some listed medieval buildings within the campus, as you probably know, Liz. So that presented one problem. So it wasn't just the money. It was, you know, how do you actually get around this? Anyway, through two, I suppose, major events, really, it became a reality in the sense that Michael Ogilvie, sadly, you know, who died now a few years ago, Mike got involved and both gave money, but also, more importantly, gave his time to sort of driving this project. The second thing that really gave it wings was the fact that the politician, Andrew Adonis, came up to do something else with the city. And he came along and was persuaded to come along and have a look at Chets, which he did. And he was, like me, you know, sort of enormously impressed with what went on there. And somehow or other, he was in the Department of Education at the time, inveigled the department to give us 9 million quid. That then, if you like, was the way, or the cornerstone, rather, of the fundraising. And then I appointed an MBA from the business school, Lucy, who was brilliant. And she just, you know, got on the phones, got on the contact list. And we had all sorts of people come along, Sainsbury family, Sainsbury Trust, a real sort of list of people who were interested in music and had money. And, you know, we raised the money, essentially.
It's that old saying, isn't it, Richard? It's not what you know, it's who you know. And for the listeners, you know, Michael Oglesby was Bruntwood. He started Bruntwood, which is a massive property company. And so it is, and it's using those contacts. And sometimes, you know, not everybody is able to give millions.
No.
But we are all able to use our contacts along the way in order to be philanthropic in our own way. And I mean, Chets is just, they turned me down, you know. I auditioned for, well, I went, yeah, when I was about 14, 15 from Manchester High, but I don't think I was probably, I mean, it was good. I'd learned the piano from the age of four. I just think maybe my mental attitude was not going to be suitable for Chets. I'm more of a party girl. So you've retired, you've got, you know, amazing stories, mega, mega achievements. And you've got probably a bigger black book than I have, which I'm a bit jealous about. What are you going to do now? Because I doubt very much that you're just going to sit there and read the Times.
Well, to be honest, I sort of take the view that I've done my bit, call it. So I tend to look at it that way. I chair an investment fund which invests in essentially growing companies, which is an area of, if you like, the commercial world, which I really enjoy. I like dealing with entrepreneurs. I like dealing with and seeing businesses grow. And so, you know, I put my two penny worth in for that. That takes me, I don't know, 3 days a month or something. And I got, you know, a couple of other people involved, so Bill Ainscoe of Wayne Holmes, who you know, Tommy Morris, you know, Liverpool multi-billionaire, And so they co-invest with us in that fund. So I do that. And as I say, that gives me a sort of business interest. I'm still involved in education. So I sit on the board at Withington Girls' School. But to be honest, otherwise, I do my garden, I play golf, and I go on holiday.
And you're happy, and you're happy. It's interesting because I've just got involved with UCLan in Preston, and I'm going on Friday. I love mentoring, and I'm going on Friday to lecture to them. I mean, I haven't got the experience or indeed the success story that you have, but I do. I love meeting people. I love the communication. I love, you know, that's my thing. And I think you're very much a people's person. And it frightens me because we are not far off age-wise. It frightens me because I don't want to stop. No. And I don't, you know, and it's very difficult finding that fine line between balancing your life, you know, in older age. I mean, I look at, you know, Iris Apfel or Joan Rivers or these women that lived wonderful, colourful lives to the end. And I think, yeah, I find that hard. So it's interesting to listen to what you do and you know, and what's on your bucket list. Well, come on, give me one thing that's on your bucket list. One thing.
One thing.
And I don't want growing a petunia in the garden or getting
No. Well, I'll give you two. One is to go to Japan, which I'm going to do next year, to ski. And two is to play the piano better.
Both doable, Richard. Both doable. Richard, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You're not that old. You've still got a lot of stories to share and tell. Thank you very much indeed.
Great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Events That Made Me. For more boardroom inspiration, make sure that you listen to my conversation with Jo Malone, CBE, to learn how she became a household name. I will be back with another conversation soon. In the meantime, do not forget to review the podcast, follow the podcast, and I'm on Instagram, Liz Taylor Consultancy.